Good morning and welcome to Neocony View. I'm Peter Newman, and if you ever drive through the town of Nehalem, North Tillamook County, there's probably a big warehouse construction area there that you may not have paid much attention to. It says Dragon Slayers on the outside, and it also says it's a fire academy. Well, this being right in the middle of fire season, I just popped in the door and wanted to find out what was going on in there. Well, Troop Emmons is the owner and designer of Dragon Slayers, and our guest this morning, and yes, we are inside your facility, so you're going to hear all sorts of logging trucks and, I don't know, bikers and all of that going on outside, but thank you for letting us in.
Oh, you're sure welcome.
What are we, can you describe a little bit about what we're looking at? Like, for example, over your shoulder, I'm seeing all these old tools, the traditional fire tools. It says the competition, cruel and unusual. Those are the old tools. Now, what about your tools?
Yeah, the old tools, they're still being sold in the GSA fire catalog, and all the firefighters, when they need a firefighting tool, they go to the GSA fire catalog and order their traditional tools, shovels, Pulaskis, McLeods, sometimes now Reinhardts, but pretty standard traditional tools that have been in use now for about 100 years.
And well, let's talk about you first. Yeah. How you even got into this? What's your story?
Well, my story is, I became a smoke jumper back in 1966. I basically grew up on the East Coast, and I went to the movies and saw this this movie Red Skies Over Montana with my brother, and walked out of that movie as a real young guy wanting to just be a smoke jumper.
Was that an adrenaline rush there? Something that just you really...
Well, it looked like a lot of fun jumping into the wilderness areas and... just all the things that you'd think that would spell out adventure and just getting into and working in really neat country. So that was the whole idea, and I sort of went through high school. I did fight some fires in the eastern United States, in Connecticut, and while I was going through high school. But then I kept writing to the smoke jumpers, and they kept saying, "Well, you know, you can't do that. You gotta come to the West and get some fire experience." So basically, I went out trying to get fire experience. I originally went to Europe to work for the Austrian Forest Service, and there weren't any fires there. But I worked for the Forest Service because I was a forester, and I took off a couple of years between my junior and senior year, and I ended up in Australia. I hitchhiked across Asia, lived with the Bedouins, and did a tremendous survival trip on camels, going across Asia, and was into all kinds of different conflicts over there, and then ended up making my way through India, and finally made it to Australia. With black market tickets and selling blood and doing all the things that young travelers do in Asia to pay their way and do things, but I ended up flat broke and totally emaciated and lived with some hobos in Sydney, and then hitchhiked up to Queensland, saw big forestry signs, and I went in and told them my story, and they gave me a job, and I ended up fighting fires up in Queensland, and then made my way from there down to southern Australia in Victoria, fought more fires down there, and then after that I went to New Zealand. And I was a government hunter over there. There weren't any fires in New Zealand. But what I did was I kept writing to all the smoke jumper bases, letting them know that I had really, hitchhiked across Asia to get to Australia to fight fires, to get enough experience to be a good smoke jumper. And I can run marathons and do so many push-ups. And nobody would ever be a better smoke jumper than me. So that was my battle cry. And I kept writing. And they didn't even know I was an American, but they hired me in Cave Junction, Oregon. And that's why I came back to America from New Zealand, which I really loved. It was very much like Oregon, and really liked the lifestyle down there. But I came back to America to be a smoke jumper. So I put in my first rookie year down in Cave Junction and loved it. It was the greatest job I ever even thought of.
Is there a personality type that gets into this sort of thing? Because let's face it, jumping out of an airplane into a fire zone is not everybody's cup of tea.
Well, there's a bunch of characters that show up for the job. There's no question about that. But they're almost all the same. They're interested in nature, or they're foresters, or something like that. They do. They are all PT nuts, runners, and just want to do things. Awful lot of Eagle Scouts and things like that. Yeah, there's kind of a standard niche. Cookie cutter thing that goes on with smoke jumpers. I kind of thought they were the most interesting until I got drafted and ended up in the Marine Corps. And I ended up actually thinking that the characters that show up in the infantry in the Marine Corps were actually a little bit more interesting because they're just so different and come from so many different backgrounds. But the smoke jumpers are all good keen men. I honestly have to say, I've never met a smoke jumper that I didn't like, really.
Our guest this morning on Neocon View is Troop Emmons. He is the owner and designer of Dragon Slayers Incorporated, which is where we are right now. So if you hear any noises in the background, it's I think we've had a fire engine. We've had logging trucks swing by this location in downtown Nehalem. Your logo, if you will, says Tools and Tactics for Wildfire Mitigators. What was the point where you said, you know, I can think of a better tool than this. I can think of better tactics than this.
Well, that's after I had like 26 seasons of smoke jumping, and I was leaning over and just having a pretty sore back with a head down. And, you know, I just sort of started thinking, you know, everybody would say, oh, God, there's never going to be a better tool than the Pulaski. And I kind of thought, well, they should improve the Pulaski. So that's what I started doing. Mostly I was still smoke jumping up in Alaska. I'd been they closed at base in Cave Junction. I went up to Alaska and jumped the Ram Airs up there. And basically it was very, very interesting, and I really got to go to a whole bunch of different wildfire ecosystems. So in other words, experienced fire under a whole different set of fuels up in Alaska. And like the East Coast, we used to go back and jump in the Eastern Appalachians and everything. But all along, I'm thinking how different the needs are on fires. And boy, most of the fire people who end up going into leadership positions, they don't ever get a lot of diverse fire. Well,
what's the difference, for example, between if there is such a thing, a typical Eastern fire versus a typical Western fire?
Well, I'll tell you what, there's a lot of difference. I can remember it's very dangerous. Actually, the fires in the Eastern United States are much more dangerous than the fires out here. It's hard to believe, but
we get all the attention.
Yeah, but actually, some of the worst fires, most deaths and everything, has all happened in east of the Mississippi River. And basically, the fuels are so flashy. It's usually the fire season is March and April. And it's like the forests are deciduous, so there's no leaves on the trees at all, and the winds and the angle of the sun beating down on the forest. Well, you can have a snowstorm and have a couple inches of snow on the ground, and then by afternoon you're jumping fires and you're dealing with incredibly dangerous fast moving fires. But all you do is you run up, you land basically the safest area you can get into, then you go to the fire and run up to the head of the fire, which is the most difficult part of the fire that's got the longest flame lengths and going to town the most. And then you just rake leaves around the whole fire, and that's firefighting in the east. Now, in the west, mostly like in the western United States, it's a situation where you You have to scrape lime down to mineral soil, and you know, you start at the tail again, and usually if the fire is hot and going, you start at the tail. But if it's not doing too bad, you can go right to the head and start your fire line there, and then you usually split your crew, and each crew works down the flanks of the fire and meet at the bottom, and then the fire is lined, and what you're really doing is you're starving the fire of fuel by making this mineral soil barrier between the continuous ground fuels. And then up in Alaska, it's really different because you cannot scrape lime down to mineral soil. The ground is filled with a gigantic organic mat, and it's really a thick mass of roots and mosses and lichens and everything, and the fire is really can burn very deep and everything, and you beat the fire out there. It's a type of grassland, only a much more difficult grassland with a very irregular ground and so forth. So that's a little bit of the differences, and just make a straight shot at trying to explain the differences in the tools and the fire tactics.
The tools that you have, one thing, as you showed me before we went on the air this morning, they're sort of multitaskers in a way. I mean, the tools, for example, above your head, the competition, cruel and unusual sign that I see, you've got, about 9 or 10 tools there, and you've got tools here which kind of flip something one way and flip it the other way, and it becomes three or more of those tools. That seems to me so obvious that why didn't somebody think of this in the past?
I didn't just wake up one morning and have the idea. What I did is I went and I rubbed shoulders with the greatest firefighters all over the world. I mean, there's a lot of people fighting these fires on the different continents, and they all have a different background, and some of them have some pretty good ideas. I thought the best idea was the swatter thing. I was in China, and I saw a guy with a pole with some inner tube lashed to it, and this was his fire tool. And I was with a Swedish guy, and he was trying to sell trucks, fire trucks, to the Chinese, and I was just trying to sort of see if they'd be interested in having smoke jumpers come over there. But anyways, he's laughing at the crudeness of this tool. And I said to him, I says, well, wait a minute. I said, he's onto something. I says, have you ever fought a tundra fire or a taiga fire? I said, we use a more primitive thing. We use a burlap bag, and our face is right in the flames. And it's very dangerous because if you carry a lot of extra burlap bags, they come sometimes catch on fire. Then you have to get away from them. And, I mean, this guy's onto something. So what I did is I just kind of used his idea, came back to America, and I first started with a aluminum pipe. Well, a steel pipe first, and then I went to aluminum, and I had conveyor belt strapping wrapped around the edge of it. But I kept improving and changing things, and eventually what I did is came up with a nylon rod, and then put the conveyor belt strapping on the end of the rod, and then a scheme to make it keep it flexible and keep the footprint. Now the footprint is now 2 feet wide and very, very comfortable for the firefighters to use. But it's not traditional, and you know, a lot of firefighters, they're so conservative, and they don't. I mean, they only do what they were trained with and introduced as far as tools go.
So are your tools catching on? Are there agencies that are buying your tools?
They mostly from the elite firefighters, the smoke jumper. Like smoke jumpers at Boise, they bought 650 sets of these tools. And I just recently went to Missoula, the Forest Service. The Forest Service jumpers don't buy anything. Of course, they're real more conservative than I think the BLM jumpers were, but the Paracargo smoke jumper, who's in charge of getting tools to all the people, he looked at these tools and he said, "Oh my God, are these new?" And I said, "Well, no, they've been used for about a decade now." With the said the BLM jumpers are using them. I said, "You didn't know about this?" And then just as luck would have it, a jumper from Missoula who had been down and jumped with the Boise guys down in the Great Basin. He comes in and says, hey, troop, how you doing? Oh, you got your tools. Oh, those are the best tools in the world. And this paracargo guy, he says, you use these tools on a fire? And he says, oh, yeah, we use them all the time down in the lower Great Basin, and they're really the best tools going. I mean, I wonder why we don't use them up here. And this guy, he was just floored. Nobody ever told him about it. They got lots of people especially the Forest Service, who were supposed to be working on better things, but they don't. They don't seem to go anywhere. And they looked upon me when I first approached them as an enemy, because who are you? Some weird little smoke jumper who's come up with something you think that will be better than what we have? I mean, that's the attitude, and they were that's dead set against me. I got a pretty good sized grant to develop all these tools when I started putting them all together and working on them. And they didn't like the fact that that I got the grant, because they thought they should be in charge. But the wildfire coordinator for all the firefighters in America said, well, you know, this guy's actually come up with some ideas that are better. You should be working with him and get your best minds to work with it. Oh, they didn't want to do that. That was not what they thought was a good idea.
Our guest this morning on the Econi View, we are in the Dragon Slayers Incorporated headquarters in Nehalem. If you've ever gone through Nehalem and seen the building there, you might have wondered what's going on inside. Well, we're in here and talking to the owner and designer, Troop Emmons. This time of year, you can't pick up a newspaper or hear radio television without a story of a fire and, you know, sometimes hundreds of homes destroyed. I mean, fire happens. When I hear a story that says hundreds of homes destroyed, my first inclination is, are those homes in the right spot to begin with? Is that a logical inference, or just stuff happens?
No, I mean, stuff happens. Granted, I think the climate is changing, and probably the people that are convinced in the purest, most evident way that is happening are the firefighters, who fight wildland firefighters.
Are fires getting worse?
Yes, they are getting worse. And what's really happening is the amount of time it takes for the fuels to dry out is shorter, and that means the fire seasons are starting earlier and lasting longer. Sometimes a lot of places in the United States now there is no anything but a fire season. They have them year round, and the tragedy that's happening is just exactly what happened with tools. Okay, we're about 100 years behind on the hand tools, but we're about at least 50 years behind the times in being able to adapt and figure out what to do about these fires. The only thing we're effective on are the low intensity to medium intensity fires, and we started getting those, and they did come up with a incident command system and mobilizing firefighters, but mostly what they created was an organization to be able to deal with the fires getting large and complicated. But the problem is that they only use the traditional methods that only work on low intensity fires. In other words, what they'll do is they'll form a big fire camp somewhere near the incident, and then they very carefully man this fire camp with firefighters that they bring in from all over, but they stay behind the event and basically try to eventually go around it. And by that time, the only way they really get around it is the fire itself wanes and they get an opportunity to go around it.
That's at the macro level. What are we doing wrong just as homeowners? I mean, around here, it's wet much of the year, and so we don't think of ourselves much in terms of fire suppression. But there was the Tillamook burn, so obviously you do get fires in this area. Are there anything that homeowners are doing wrong or could be doing differently that would ensure their houses are safer?
For sure. It's time to adapt. We've got to change our whole manner in which we position ourselves because of the fact. Now, yeah, it's different. It's usually wet here, but all it takes is you watch the ground. If it goes 2 weeks with no rain, the grass all gets brown. So
and that's fuel.
It changes. Oh yeah, yeah. Well, it's an indication that things are drying out, yeah. and of course it dries out everywhere, even in the forest where you got lots of shade and everything. But here's the trade off on a ecosystem that's really wet and heavy, like here on the temperate coastal forest. There's more organic matter that grows as far as weight goes than in any other ecosystem on the planet. There's more of it in the whole coast from California all the way up to Alaska than there is, like, say, in a tropical rainforest. It's just that's the way it is. But here's the thing. There's so many when that dries out, the control problems that you would have in this type of ecosystem are much greater than the control problems you would have in a central Oregon or eastern Oregon type ecosystem where you've got ponderosa pine and just grass. The duff and everything here makes the control problems much, much more difficult.
So I've got a home here or a farm. What should I be doing different?
Well, first off, what you should do is ignore the ideas of just depending on having the local firefighters do it. I mean, they're great, and I'll say this right now: smoke jumpers and most of the fire crews, the engine types, and everything, they're far greater now today than they ever were. So that's truly what exists. But the problem is the conditions are so much more difficult to deal with than there are, and we're not adapting to it. So actually, I'll try to explain this. Okay, the worst, the fastest fuel is your grasses. And most houses have grasses around them. And the problem is, like, let's take Texas for example. Texas in 2011, they had 4,000 houses burned down, and I went to a wildland urban interface meeting, and the Texas state forester came, and he showed the hoax of all the houses, a lot of the houses that had burned down, and around the house was basically, you could tell it was just grass. So it was the burning grass moving at a real high speed rate that went up and burned the houses down. Now, the other way a house burns down is from embers going to it and catching on the roof litter and litter that is around the house, and also even shrubs and that sort of thing. So if you're really serious about protecting your house, first off, you do have to convert it to a managed fuel scenario. In other words, you take your natural forest, you thin it and you prune it. You get rid of those ladder fuels, the little branches that go from the ground all the way to the top, and you make sure you isolate your larger trees and so forth. So there's got to be about a 20-foot break between where the crowns are touching. And then what you have to do, make sure you have a clean house, no litter and no shrubs up against the house. And what I think you really should do is put in an inorganic ring around the house, a sort of a patio with brick and mortar or asphalt or even plastic on the ground, visqueen, and then put gravel on top of that. And that keeps the pioneer species of grasses and so forth from growing in there. So you got a clean place. And that should be about, 8 feet or so away from out from the whole house, all the way around it. And then if you really got to have you know, plants and so forth right near the house, put them in 55-gallon containers or half containers or these nice pots that they sell at the nursery stores, and then make them mobile so you can always roll them out away from the house if there is a large inferno heading towards your house. And then the next thing that you need to do, you've created a basic savanna for a couple hundred feet all the way around your house. In other words, trees, yeah, you don't want to have a parking lot. Just have trees and grasses, but keep things natural. Let the grass and so forth be what it is, because here's the deal. There's not enough water in the West, for example, for everybody to irrigate and keep a real green deal. But what you do is you go out another 100 feet or so and put a circular control line all the way around the thing you want to protect, and then you do another one. And what I do is I go around, especially in Europe, they're concerned with it, terrorists using fire as a weapon. And so what they've done is they've hired me to go over there, and I teach the fire management for the individual homeowner who chooses to live in the fuels. And that's what we have to do. And it has to be an attitude. The attitude has to be my home, my land, my responsibility. Get away from the idea that the firefighters are going to come and be able to take care of your house. Look what's happening and what has been happening for this last decade. I mean, we're talking about losing consistently 5,000 houses a year. And it's not because the firefighters aren't any good. It's just because, really, every homeowner who lives in the fuels must become a land manager. It's a military type positioning thing. What you need to do is you need to look upon the world as you shape the battle space so that you can't lose. You will always preside and win. And you have to be willing to understand the mechanics of what's coming at you. If you look out and see a large fire and you know there's not enough resources for any of the poor old firefighters to be able to do anything, they cannot do it. It's being proved over and over again. You know, they're good on the easy ones, but they're not on the deadly fires that take out people and homes. They're not able to do it. So you can, in fact, set your house up so that you can actually systematically release all the calories around that the vegetation that's around your house, so that what we call it is you can split the ball, because the real bad firestorms, there's a ball of burning gases that keep rolling. And defensible space, great start, but here's what they don't tell you about defensible space. It burns houses down faster in extreme events.
Boy, we could be talking about this for an hour, and I think it's fascinating. I'm going to direct folks to your website. You are True Beamans, who is the owner and designer of Dragon Slayers Incorporated. We are in your headquarters in Nehalem, and because you just have so much great information, I think folks should go to your website, because it's a great place to start. It is dragonslayers.com, and you can learn even more about this fascinating and regrettably important subject. And thank you for your work with all this great equipment and your tactical work as well.
Well, it's a pleasure. Just have somebody come in and visit my humble little factory here.
It's a great place. You should give tours. I'm Peter Newman. Please join me next month for another edition of The Econi View.